Members, the State Government Finance Committee for Tuesday, February 28th will come to order. Looks like everybody's taken their seat. We do have a quorum. Please take out the minutes from the previous meeting. Take a good look. Make sure you were there.
Mr. Chairman, I would move approval of Thursday's minutes.
We have a motion for the minutes. All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Before we get started, just so that you know, our illustrious leader is ill today, and you know that Maury's not here. Even when he's sick, he's really sick. So we'll wish him the best. Okay. Members, the first bill we're going to take up will be the Drazkowski bill, House File 1975. And you remember that was a bill that we heard and took testimony pro and con last week. There was some discussion about laying the bill over for additional comments and potential amendments, but bringing it back this morning, Representative Drazkowski, to your bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Mr. Chair, members, I think we vetted the bill pretty good last time. I know that Representative Kahn had some questions about what he talked about, you know, what about insider trading and some of the conflict of interest type potential around the bill, and I understand she has an amendment but may not be bringing it. Maybe Mr. Chair, Representative Kahn would like to speak.
Representative Kahn.
Mr. Chairman, with the excellent help, of course, of Mark Shepard, we drew up an amendment, and I looked at it really carefully. I guess I could have shown it to you, too. I showed it to a few members, and it looked like it would really take care of any problem, but it looks so complicated in terms of a rules administration and that kind of thing, and the kinds of things that that we'd have to do to put it into place, that even I thought it was a little too much government at this point. And so I think it was something that it might be a little bit better to wait and see if there's a problem and how to specifically attach the problem than it would be to try and put this amendment on. So I still think, you know, it's something that we should keep our eyes open for, but I didn't think this amendment was ready to go on the bill. So I did not. I drew it up and handed it in to meet the 12 o'clock. Mark drew it up, and I handed it in to meet the 12 o'clock deadline because we don't have a deadline on withdrawing it, and then I withdrew it later in the day. So your bill is free to go as it is.
Representative Drazkowski, the bill is recommended to pass and go to Ways and Means. Do you have any comments about as amended?
Really not any further comments, Mr. Chair. Well, a little bit, maybe just around Representative Kahn, maybe put the committee even more at ease around some of the points or questions that were raised last time. I think there's about a 25-page publication that looks at the ethics and conflict of interest that's put together by, I think it's Department of Administration, that should be helpful, that refers to several different statutes around that. Also, I draw members' attention to Section 609.42. I don't know if that has been shared with people, dealing with bribery and the bribery statutes. I think we're covered, Representative Kahn, maybe better than we knew we were. But Mr. Chair, other than that, I think, as I mentioned, I think the bill was vetted very well. All the bill does is works to remove the limitations that are placed before the state agency and allows them to consider all factors before them before deciding whether to contract. So I would ask for the committee's support.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes.
One other comment. Sorry, Maury isn't here to hear this personally, but I guess I want to thank him for instead of getting into a conflict of having to have a roll call vote on laying over and that kind of thing, I thank him for just doing it so we could just take another look at it and come to a much more reasonable solution. I still don't like the bill, but I'm not going to try and mess with it. So,
thank you, Representative Kahn. Is there any further discussion on the bill? Okay, all in favor, say aye.
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 All opposed?
No.
The bill is passed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Committee.
What's this bill about? We passed this this week? Where does it go?
Next, we're going to have Secretary Ritchie come up and give us a demonstration of the technology involved in poll books.
I think.
Representative, or Secretary Ritchie.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members. Thank you so much for this opportunity. We know time is precious, so we want to share with you what we think is exciting new opportunities because the cost of technology has fallen and the dependability of technology has risen, leading us to an opportunity today to use one of the new pieces, an electronic poll book that looks something like this, to accomplish three very important tasks. First, to help lower the cost to local election officials of much of the post-election data entry, avoiding some of the clerical errors and the delays and the kind of time it takes. So this is something that our local officials are very interested in, and some have already experimented with and used this technology. Second, it allows all of us to use more electronic data matching, so our voter registration lists are up to date to the very last minute, able to use electronic and digital list matching technology to make sure that we've captured all the information about who might have died in the last minute, who might still be a felon on paper, not yet eligible to vote, etc. So this is an important benefit. It can improve and make easier for some voters. But perhaps the most important part about this new technology is it allows us to accomplish the very important task of bringing visual verification of voters into the polling place. I'd like to show you an example of what it would look like for an election official. I think you might have a paper version of this.
It works.
If you want to just, we have a copy like this in front of you.
That's what it shows.
We can use this for the moment. This is an example of what a electronic poll book would look like when a voter came into the polling place. We have an expert here.
Really?
Three of them. Why is that black guy that was running the Democrats?
Great. When a voter would come into the polling place, the electronic poll book would have this screen. Their picture would be there right in front of their face, and they could visually verify the voter. If you were in a small township, maybe without electricity or without some of the conveniences of the modern life, you could have those photographs printed on the paper poll book. This is, of course, a very low cost and very, very high-tech solution to the question of how to bring visual verification into the polling place itself. We've been working closely with the electronic poll book companies. One of the most important, there's only really four major ones. One of those four happens to be a Minnesota company, a very convenient circumstance for us. They've been very generous with their time coming and providing testimony for us. And I guess we may have this in a second. Thank you very much. And DataCard has provided for us a couple examples that we've been able to share with you, and some of you have even met with some of their representatives. But essentially what they said to us was there are very, very expensive ways and very complicated ways to do visual verification of voters, and there are some very inexpensive ways, especially by bringing the technology and the photographs into the polling place. One of the real advantages to this, of course, is that it allows for the individual election judge to be part of that verification process. but it has other advantages that might be very important to all of us as citizens and to you as lawmakers. Number one, it avoids a huge cost, the cost of the systems that we've seen up to date. The second is that it avoids disruption of our basic systems, our absentee voting system, our election day registration system. It avoids that disruption of those systems. Number three, it's something that can be done very easily and relatively quickly. This printing it so that the pictures would be available on a paper poll book can happen very quickly. So bringing up an electronic system would take some piloting, which a little bit has been done already, but it would take some time. But essentially, this could be done quickly, and it could avoid many of the other problems that we've seen with the problems of senior citizens who have given up their IDs many years ago, no longer carry them or have them, citizens who are overseas and have a difficult time getting all their paperwork or their birth certificate, citizens who've lost their wallet or their wallet has been stolen and they're in that weird time frame where they've notified Department of Motor Vehicles, but they have not yet received their duplicate or their replacement ID or driver's license. This particular technology, we've had some discussions within our election integrity task force, because we see it as part of a solution for making sure that our notification and our procedures around felons who are not yet completed with their sentence to make sure they don't inadvertently or intentionally vote. So we've had some opportunities to vet this idea from several different angles, but now we think that the technology's there, the price has fallen dramatically, and the procedure for making this something that we could do quickly is in front of us. The last benefit I will suggest to you is that it also is the possibility of something that a broad bipartisan support could be assembled for. This is something that Governor Pawlenty and I discussed a lot during his administration, how to make sure when we bring the legislation forward, it has broad support. Governor Carlson before him, Governor Dayton since him. I believe this can begin to be an approach that is affordable, doesn't disrupt our systems, but brings us the kind of visual verification of voters in the polling place we would all like to have. With that, Mr. Chairman, thank you again for the time, and I'd love to take any questions.
Thank you, Secretary Ritchie. Representative Murphy.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Secretary Ritchie, where do you get the photo in the first place?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, the photos would come from the Department of Motor Vehicles. They have our identification photos, our driver's license photos. They also have our photos going back 12 years for our mostly senior citizens who've given up their driver's license or quit driving for whatever reason. They have those photos as well. For individuals who are coming into the polling place, let's say they're doing same-day registration, and they don't have a Minnesota driver's license, but they have either a student ID or an ID that is easy to scan in, that would be the source for those individuals. And for that small number of people, let's say seniors in a nursing home where the election judge is going out to assist them and their photo isn't in the system, they would have a camera, it would be easy to take their picture to add them to the system. But the vast majority would come directly from the Department of Motor Vehicle. And in our planning conversations with them, it's been surprising how simple that procedure appears to be. We feel very confident about this.
Mr. Chair, yes. Secretary, the person would still have to go to Department of Motor Vehicles then? Not to the voter registration clerk?
Mr. Chair, Representative Murphy, the person would go to vote as they would normally vote. They would be in the system if any time in the last 12 years or any time, you know, currently, they had any form of ID. But if they were so old that they had given up their license many years ago and there wasn't a photograph of them, then you could just simply take their picture in the polling place or, you know, wherever they might be. We would urge people to always be updating their driver's license because there are many important reasons to keep your driver's license current. That's a different question, you know, for public safety reasons and other reasons. But with this system, what's brilliant about DataCard's proposal and how they framed it is that technology now and the cost of memory storage is so cheap, you could have all of the pictures right there on the polling book.
Wow.
And you can then just access the pictures from the Department of Motor Vehicle that you've downloaded for either that precinct or whatever region you might like to choose.
Representative.
So, Mr. Chair, and then Secretary Ritchie, then these 400,000 Minnesotans that are under 400,000 Minnesotans that don't currently have IDs, their picture would be taken if they went to vote.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Murphy, there are 84,000 current voters without IDs. We don't know what percent, but a certain percent of them are in the back file of the Department of Motor Vehicles that goes back 12 years. Those 84,000 who currently vote without IDs are older people, not all, but a chunk. So those who would be in that group, whoever was not in the DMV, could have their picture taken at the polling place when they showed up. There is another about 131,000 people who have the wrong address, but of course they're in the system, so they're already in the DMV system. And there's about 20,000 in any day that have lost licenses or had them stolen. We don't know exactly the number, but who are also, of course, in the DMV system because they have a license, it just happens to be lost or stolen for the moment. So the 84,000 who we now know vote but have no ID, a portion of them will have photos because they gave up their license in the last 12 years. Those that are left can have their picture taken in the polling place with ease. I mean, the new technology is very cheap and very easy.
Representative Murphy, follow up. Representative Leidiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Secretary, I'd like to explore a little bit about the database behind the poll book. And I have a couple of questions. I just want to quickly go through them. You know, who protects this database? How is it updated? Is it updated centrally, or is this updated by the counties? Or does it go down to precinct levels? I mean, local input, or is it a centralized system? Can you speak to that a little bit first? And I've got another question mm-hmm. after that, please.
Secretary Richard.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, the statewide voter registration system is basically county-owned and controlled, but it's kept centrally in one system so that if somebody moves, it's easy to keep track of them. There are some changes that are allowed to the database centrally. For example, every 4 years, if you have not voted, you are purged from the active list by the Help America Vote Act of the federal government. But generally speaking, when we run the database against the 8 different database systems that we use to cross-check your eligibility, we forward that information to the county auditors, the chief election official. Sometimes they have a different name, but typically it's the county auditor. And they make the final determination in terms of marking a challenge, or if somebody has died, saying, yes, that is this Jim Johnson, they should be removed as somebody who's dead. So it's kept in a central computer system, but it can only be altered fundamentally by the county election official, not by township, not by city, but by county. We send them the data that we get from the matching process, and then they make that determination if that's the proper Jim Johnson or whoever that is.
Okay. Senator Leidiger.
Thank you. So, okay, so I understand who updates it and who controls it. And the data, is that being continuously updated by DMV records then?
Secretary Ritchie.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Leidiger.
Every night from DMV, there's a computer sending of information. For example, if somebody gets a driver's license and checks the box or says, I've moved or whatever, that happens at night. If somebody doesn't have a driver's license and they've submitted a voter registration form, that goes through the Social Security Administration in that way. We get different databases on a different schedule. For example, the National Death Registry, we only use a little bit. The State Department of Public Health Death Register, we use more often. So some things are being checked every night around midnight, middle of the night. Some things are being checked periodically during the course of the year. We get updates from the courts. We get updates from the Department of Corrections. We get updates on some citizenship data from Department of Public Safety. But the thing that is happening on a daily basis comes from the Department of Vehicle Services with the nightly exchange of information.
Senator Leidiger. So this is currently happening now, of course. Okay, I'm going to assume that then. Let's talk about the machine hookup to the database. I'm assuming it's just the internet. If you have an internet connection at the precincts, this is hooked up so that at a polling place you might have 10 of these, and as long as you've got broadband or some sort of a level of connection, they'll work. And also, so please confirm that. And then also, can it be taken out of state? I mean, what the thought that came through my mind is, you send it overseas to our guys that are stationed somewhere, and that may be a little unrealistic. Go ahead,
Secretary Ritchie.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, let me take the first one, because what's beautiful about this system is that it's not connected to the internet. It does not require internet or broadband. The system that's the least expensive is that late in the week prior to the election, when all of the database matching is done, the database is marked and it's on a stick, and it's distributed in secure ways to the county election officials and to the person doing the election at the local level. So it's not connected to the internet. There's no way people could get in. It doesn't require broadband. You know, we have 2,000 townships with voting. Some don't have electricity. They have generators. You know that whole thing. So that's the beauty, and that's why this system is so inexpensive in a certain way. But you just asked a question about overseas that I have not thought about. But, for instance, could there be a so-called precinct that was someplace else? In one of the problems in the recount of making sure that an absentee voter's ballot did not end up identifying themselves or how they voted, there was a precinct created called an absentee voter precinct. So I'm no lawyer, as they say, but you are imagining into a future that begins to tackle other problems. Right now, we feel pretty satisfied with sort of the advances that the legislature has made with sending ballots electronically and stuff like that. But you asked a question that has triggered my mind in thinking about some other issues. For instance, in places that have gotten really isolated, could you move this equipment in a way that made it more convenient, like someplace where people gather? I hadn't thought it through, but I appreciate very much just the way of thinking about it.
Representative Light.
One follow-up, because I'm not sure I'm understanding this. If it's not hooked up directly to the database, so where's the data?
Secretary Ritchie.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, in the machine. The cost of memory has fallen so dramatically that it would be in the machine, and you would load it through a stick, so to speak.
Representative Leidiger.
So, is the entire database in every machine, or is it partitioned by the roles that are in that precinct.
Secretary.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, this would be a decision. Typically, in a multi-county situation, you might want, like, let's say the auditor in Stearns County has to deal with a lot of students and people from that area. That person, that auditor, might want the counties that surround him. But the physical, the technology could hold the entire database, and it could be partitioned to your precinct if you so choose.
Follow-up?
No, I'm finished. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Having had the benefit of being on the Integrity Task Force, we had a good discussion this last meeting, and it was brought up. Mm-hmm. Not only, you know, could the technology potentially be a laptop, but there are a number of tablet devices that might be able to do the same thing. We don't have anything to demo on a mobile system like an Android or an Apple or anything at this point, but the Android device that was demonstrated somewhat by the Ramsey County official, you know, has the ability to take the picture right in the tablet and store it and put it right into the file. So there's still a lot of work to be done to decide how it would roll out. My question, Secretary, is we talked a little bit. I know that the topic came up when we had DataCard in, but the cost per unit, and will it also incorporate some kind of scanning system to assist with, you know, speeding up the process?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, in fact, there's sort of two processes in our polling places, thinking about it for a second. One is the coming in front, and if you're registered, you're all set to go. There's that. There's also the Election Day registration system. It turns out that in the Minnetonka pilot, they use two different systems for scanning for Election Day registration and have found one they really liked and have already purchased it. So one of them is just a small flatbed. You take your driver's license, you put it on it, it scans it, it lifts your information and your photo right onto whatever form we come up with. And then in their case, they print it out and sign it. You could also use a digital pad and sign it in that way. And so that smaller piece of equipment is even less expensive, but even the bigger ones now, I think the last contract that was let was somewhere in the $600 range, and I don't know how big a memory that was, but certainly the price of just plain old computers has come down dramatically, and the cost of the scanning for the same-day registration would be even slightly less. So one of the advantages, of course, of the paper solution is not just that you could do this quickly, possibly even this year, but also this would be for a township a very low cost, I mean essentially a zero cost. But if a township or town or county saw that the expense of typing in all that data afterwards was costing them more than an investment in a relatively low-cost piece of equipment, we may find that towns and townships, some, and counties want to move in the direction of this kind of technology for many reasons, but one being to save them money. So this might be a starting point, but you can feel in people's comments that they want to move into the future.
Secretary Ritchie, I know we've discussed it, and you've kind of scratched out a few numbers in terms of the number of units necessary to get the job done, and having some backups potentially just in case. Can you give us an idea of how many we might be purchasing? Give them an approximate cost. I know if this proceeds eventually beyond the show that we're having today, we'll have to get to a fiscal note and like. But you have a number in mind.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. Thank you. Right now, there's about 4,000 polling places, of which about 500 are all mail. So this does not affect absentee voters, mail-in voters, the township voters. So we start at 3,500 polling places. 500 of those townships are pretty small. So let's, for the moment, just say they would use a non-electronic version. That would leave us about 3,000 polling places. If you had two machines, between 600 and 1,000 each, let's call it 1,500. So let's say you had 1,000 of them out of 1,500, that would be 1.5 million. And let's say you added more machines, two more machines, so 2,000 polling places at 2,000 polling places at about $3,000, so that's about $6,000. So 1.5 million, 6 million, bring you to 7.5 million. Assuming 500 of the smallest townships would go to a paper version, if you added those, of course, then you would add, you know, another, you know, 750,000. So you might go between 8 and 9 million if you included all of those townships, but you could keep it down to between 7 and 8, you know, if some of them use paper. In our minds, we imagined going to paper as the way to, you know, work out the computer part and then going, so it could also be phased. But yes, there would be a cost, and we feel there's momentum because people think this is also valuable for many other reasons, not just this one. So we also consider that a real plus to this idea that we would be investing our dollars into something that will make the future less expensive, more efficient, and with higher integrity. Some of the other ideas would invest a lot of money, but it wouldn't necessarily buy us, you know, the future technology.
I know we had a poll book demonstration last session when Representative Kiffmeyer brought forward the photo ID bill. That was a huge component of her bill. So we've been working on it for some time. And, you know, so the technology's been there. When we talked to DataCard, they've implemented this in many other states. Is it really the only new additional item with the software and updated the way we've now taken a look at it is just the addition of the photo?
Mr. Chairman, two things. The photo is the most important change by far. But the notion that we could do this with standalones because of the size of the ability to have a very large memory at a very low cost is a very big change from the interactivity, interconnectivity, the sort of real-time. We have 400 or 4,000 polling places. Many probably could never have broadband. So the bringing of the picture is what makes it really useful to people. But I think having it be standalone, because as you mentioned, we do need to have a 10% reserve for things. So if your interactivity goes down, you're in big-time trouble. But if you just have a machine go down, you can make that replacement.
Thank you. Representative Gunther.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Secretary, you mentioned felons. I look at this picture. Is it possible to have the Department of Corrections give you a list of felons that you could just simply across the person's face say, felon?
Secretary Richie.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, yes. Right now, we actually get list combination from the courts and corrections. And thank you, Mr. Chairman, is bringing a bill before this.
No, GovOps first.
GovOps, sorry. Before the legislature to improve the access, because these are legal matters, to the corrections list. I don't know about the putting of the bar across, but one of the real advantages to the electronic version is that you can put a lot of information, and we now put challenge, F, felon, and if somebody comes in and that is marked, there's a whole dialogue. They may say, I'm not that Jim Johnson, then they have to sign a sworn oath and there's an investigation. But one of the advantages of electronic poll books is that you can mark that poll book record up until Thursday or Friday in the week before, so you have a very narrow window as opposed to, you know, a couple times a year you go in and do it. So one of the real things that we're excited about the legislation that Representative Benson will be carrying is that it gives us real-time access in to be able to update our list with who has, you know, in the last few days or whatever the time frame might be, been convicted and sentenced in a felony offense in Minnesota, therefore losing their right. And we also think that this will help us be able to make sure that people don't inadvertently, because we can also send them a letter, you know, beforehand saying, listen, just to remind you, this isn't something to do. And I think this legislation that's coming forward is an excellent outcome of a strong process we had this last year in our task force. I'm very proud of that work, and I think it'll be a great bill. Thank you.
Representative, any follow-up? I just hope that you haven't given him an idea that bill's going to be heard this week.
Oh, sorry.
I sure hope that my picture doesn't show up with felon underneath it as a demo. Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just thinking back to the discussion we had last year on the photo ID bill when we had electronic rosters in Representative Kiffmeyer's first bill, and we were having extensive discussions about the cost, and I think in general this is a great concept and one that we've talked about in terms of more effectively implementing a photo ID requirement. And I just have a few questions in general and then some about the details. So if I understand this right, we could, as voters under a photo ID requirement in Minnesota, we could choose to have our photos electronically uploaded into the poll books and kind of available to the staff either on paper or on an electronic device, or if for whatever reason part of that group that doesn't have one in the state system somewhere, I could still show up and present my own personal ID and verify my identity. Is that a fair statement?
Secretary Ritchie.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Downey. No, the process of verification would remain the same. For example, students must have their name forwarded to us and address from the administration before they can use their student ID, which would be a form of a non-state government-issued ID, as their proof of their identity, and the university information as proof of residency. And that none of that would change. The procedures that we use to verify voters in the polling place now would not change, but our ability to get their photograph and bring it into the system, if for some reason we didn't have it, would be facilitated by this technology.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chair and Mr. Secretary, I'm not sure you answered my question. I'm contemplating a future state where you would have to verify your identity with a photograph of some kind in the future. And it looks to me like if this were done, whatever percentage of us in Minnesota who are registered to vote, I'm not sure what the percentage is, looks like it's 80 or 90% of us would already have our photos in the poll book or on a tablet or something when we walk in. And those of us who did not, we could still show up and bring a card, a photo ID on a card, and still be able to vote. So this would just be another mechanism to make it easier for us to present our IDs at the polls under photo ID. That was my question.
Secretary Ritchie. Mr. Chairman, Representative Downey, we haven't contemplated any changes to how the procedure for the verification would take place. And if I'm hearing your question correctly, certainly students on the list who brought their student ID would fit right in, you know, into that process. Passports are typically described as one of those things that meet the standard of identification. So I don't think we've contemplated very deeply if any changes would be necessary in how we currently verify our voters. But I think the goal is to move towards having as many, if possible, all, but maybe we can't get their photos already in the system, and then thinking through those exceptions to that rule carefully to make sure that we don't have any problem with the integrity of the system.
Representative Downey.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Well, Mr. Secretary, I'm still not sure you're answering my question. You keep talking about your current process for registering voters. But the current process doesn't require a photo ID of any kind, so I'm not sure why having a photo on the poll books makes any sense absent a photo ID requirement. And that's, I think I would support the use of this technology for that very reason. It would make it a lot easier for folks to have their IDs validated, their photos validated at the point of showing up at the polling places. So I think I like this idea. And it seems to be very consistent with what Representative Kiffmeyer was proposing 2 years ago or a year ago, whenever we were seriously hearing the first version of her bill that had the electronic roster proposal in it. But a couple of questions. I know in the local government fiscal note. I just had a chance to look at it from that bill. The cost was somewhere around $25 to $30 million to deploy this technology, and I don't think that even really had any implementation costs. And these are big, complicated implementations. You got to redesign the processes and train all the workers and all of that. And I appreciate the technology may have come down a little bit, but you still have very, very large numbers. And so, do you have an implementation plan that lays out what these costs are, how you would get it done? To kind of make some of my questions, what is your proposal here? I mean, this is interesting technology. It looks snazzy. We see a picture on a screen, and that all seems great. But what is the proposal? Do you have an implementation plan, and do you know the actual cost of implementing this technology statewide?
Secretary Richards.
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Downey. I mean, in our minds, going to a paper system, perhaps even this year, a essentially free system, and then getting competitive bids from the major companies would be a next step on pilots for next year in a kind of a quieter year, 2013, and taking the results of that to take competitive bids for 2014. I've been meeting extensively with one company, but also today or tomorrow, the representatives of the biggest company are coming in, and they've sent a kind of a estimated time that it would take them to redo. They estimated at 250 hours to redo their system. So I feel like the vendors are always anxious to be helpful, but we need to treat them in an orderly procurement process. The rolling out of this without expecting internet connectivity in 4,000 mostly townships or half townships and many other places makes this a much simpler process, but the moving target of the tablets and all of that adds complexity to the thinking process, because we wouldn't want to spend money, $7 million, $20 million, anything, if we weren't really taking into account where the technology is going. And I very much appreciate your constant bringing back to the complexity of the systems themselves. We met with Department of Motor Vehicles. They were, quite aware of how they would consider doing this. We saw an example from Ohio where they have bringing things in. We could see how they have done that. We are trying to take into account the changes that would be on our side with a statewide voter registration system. But if you are aiming towards a paper implementation and then electronic with some testing in the middle, we feel a lot of confidence in our ability to do that by watching. Since I started talking about this, my colleagues, the Secretary of State of Maine and Secretary of State of Colorado, have gotten very interested, and DataCard is flying up to Maine Monday, and I think maybe to Colorado soon. So I also think there may be other states, and so that sharing part of the thinking process and the cost of the thinking will start to happen over some other markets as well, and I think that's a big plus.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman, thank you, and Mr. Secretary. So I find myself getting more and more confused as we go here. It sounds like you'd have some kind of a phased implementation, so we'd have some precincts that would have a photo requirement, in essence, to show up and vote. You couldn't pretend to be somebody at those precincts if your face didn't match the face that's on the poll book. And so we'd have one set of precincts that, in effect, have a photo ID requirement, or a photo validation of your identity requirement, and we'd have some that don't, which in my mind presents a huge problem, because you got one group of voters in the state that are subject to a certain degree of identity validation to vote, and you'd have a bunch of precincts that don't. So I'm really confused here. I mean, under the premise of a photo ID requirement, I think this makes great sense. Absent photo ID, I can't imagine that we'd be sticking people's photos on poll books. I mean, what's the purpose? What's the point? It's snazzy, but it does nothing absent a photo ID law. And so I don't know where you're coming from with this proposal. I get confused. I don't know why we'd implement snazzy technology with photos on it unless we were serious about asking people to verify who they are when they show up at a poll location. And I'm just looking at some of the numbers too. And I don't quite know how what you had in the local government impact note under Representative Kiffmeyer's bill lines up with what you're talking about, but you had things in there where precincts with between 101 and 249 registered voters would need one workstation. Precincts with between 250 voters and 499 would need two workstations. Anything over 501 registered voters would need three computers. And then there's scanners and cables and software. And now we're talking about cameras and tablets and printers and, you know, gotta have backups and all this kind of stuff. So I just don't know where we're going with this. And if the intent is to show some fancy technology that shows you can put a picture of somebody on a tablet or on a poll book, I mean, that doesn't seem like rocket science to me. You could probably do that today under your existing SVRS just by changing some of the codes. So I don't know where we're going with this. And I think in order for us to have any ability to act on it, we need an actual proposal. We need to have some sense that it can truly be implemented, that it can be implemented fairly across all the precincts of the state, so we don't have an uneven photo ID requirement across the state while you'd be implementing this. And then the interaction of this with typical or traditional card IDs, how that would work. So I just don't know what we're talking about here today. And then if I could, Mr. Chair, one final question on the numbers. I've heard some really wild statements out there about 700,000 people in Minnesota being disenfranchised if we implemented a photo ID requirement, and yet you're saying that only 84,000 people who are currently registered to vote in Minnesota right now don't have an ID on file with Department of Motor Vehicles, and maybe even some portion of that really does. They're just not active, so they're in the archives somewhere. So I'm just curious, when we talk about the people who would have to get an ID under a photo ID requirement, is it 700,000 or is it 80,000 less the people who actually have a historical ID on file with DMV?
Secretary Ritchie.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Downey, first let me take your first point. We've always said this would be implemented statewide in all precincts. Some people might want to do it on paper. Some people might want to do it electronically. So I'm not sure if I miscommunicated in a way that sounded like some precincts would do it and some would not, but it would be statewide. If you'd like to do it this year, it would be necessary to do it in one system, but in the future there could be other technologies. This year paper would be possible, but that's a different thing. So I'm sorry if I miscommunicated on that point. I don't know about the 700,000. I know that Indiana had to provide 700,000 free IDs, so I don't know what that number is. I really have no knowledge of that. But we know that 84,000 people currently voting do not have IDs. 131,000 currently voting have the wrong address. And some number, 10, 20,000, we don't really know, are on any day of the week without their ID because of being lost or stolen and waiting for their replacement. Of the 84,000, a number of them don't have IDs, but if we were implementing the system of putting the photographs into the polling place, their photographs would still be in the back files of the 12 years of prior photographic representations that the Department of Motor Vehicle had. We don't know how many. It might be possible to find out. But 84,000 people are currently voting, and probably some since Roosevelt, who don't have IDs. 131,000 have the wrong address, and some 10,000, 20,000 are simply out of luck for the moment, waiting to get their replacement.
Ms. Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Beth Frazier with the Office of the Secretary of State. The 700,000 number comes from the testimony I provided to the Senate hearing on the proposed constitutional amendment, and that was our estimate of the impact of the bill that was heard. There have been several delete all amendments, so it was one version of the bill that was heard in the Senate, and it was the 84,000 people who don't have IDs, the 130,000 people who have a different address on their ID from the address at which they're registered, 500,000 people who typically do election day registration in a presidential election year, because our reading of the language of that version of the Senate bill and of definitely of the House language would eliminate election day registration. The House language, we also believe, would eliminate absentee balloting and mail balloting, so that's another 250,000 people. So we believe the House language of the proposed Constitution Amendment would actually be closer to 1 million people because it requires identical verification standards before voters are eligible to vote. And as far as we can tell, there's no way to have identical verification standards for same-day registrants as you do for people who vote, who pre-register, and there's no way to have identical verification standards for somebody who is mailing in a ballot as somebody who's standing in front of you and handing you an ID and you're looking at them.
Representative Downey.
Mr. Chairman, I'm still confused how it is that everybody in Minnesota who's registered to vote has an ID except 84,000 people, but maybe those are technical idiosyncrasies with the bill language as compared to just the common sense understanding of it. But I'll just make a statement and then I'll be done. But I have no idea why our Secretary of State is bringing to us a proposal to put photos on poll books unless we have a photo ID requirement. I mean, I don't think we could probably legally even do this if we didn't have a photo ID requirement in Minnesota. What is the purpose of putting photos on poll books all over the state or doing it incrementally in some kind of a phased piloted implementation plan? I'm just not understanding what the proposal is and how it would work and how we would implement it, and I'll just leave it at that.
Representative McElpatrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Secretary, I have some concerns about the process of the data entry. I wonder if you could explain to me how the data would be entered into this base under various circumstances. If much of it is coming from motor vehicle, is that entered automatically? Is it entered manually? What about the local counties where people come in to register? Could you explain that to me, please?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative. So right now, every night at midnight, roughly the middle of the night, people who have checked the box and said we'd like to register to vote with the Department of Motor Vehicle, you know, they've gone in to get a license or to change it, that information is sent automatically. If there's a driver's license, which of course there would be, then that information is forwarded on in a queue to the county auditors, who are the ones responsible for all voter registration lists. It's their list. We can't make changes to it. We can't make markings. It's up to the county auditor to do that. They typically also handle the data entry of people who write on a voter registration form, you know, the little cards we used to have or the larger ones. That's their responsibility to do that as well. Once they've entered it into the system, all names in the system are subjected to the various forms of eligibility verification. There are 8 databases that can be used. Some of them are used to back up others, and then there's the voter verification postcard, the non-forwardable postcard as well. So once the names are in the system, if at some point they would become a felon or some point they would die, that information would go back to the counties based on a scan or a comparison of the entire database. And it would be for the county official's decision that that was the correct Jeff Johnson or whatever name it might be.
Representative McElpatrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Secretary, if the data is being entered automatically from the DMV, correctly, then how is it scrutinized? Let's say this is a late entry shortly before Election Day. How is the election day eligibility verified? Is that done automatically? How do they run that through? Perhaps you answered that, but I still need clarification on that.
Secretary.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, almost all the verifications start with the process of verifying either with Department of Vehicle Services or with Social Security. Those are the two immediate ones. The postcard is then used right at that moment. And then the other verifications on citizenship, on felon, on guardianship, on death, all of those other ones are done on a periodic basis, and then they are done right in the last period right before the elections. There's typically a several days. You know, this has to be completed somewhere near the very end, and so that there is, you know, always a day or two that's not under the scan or the cross-checking that has happened, but that's typically what happens to the data at the very end. We are we know that using electronic list matching allows us to do this later and later, but there will always be some gap in that process.
Representative McElfatrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one last question. If you have personnel then that are working on this list, is that what you're saying, that there will be some, it will not be done entirely automatically through the computer? How do we verify the security that there's no adjustments being made to the list of eligible voters?
Secretary Richards.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, well, there are 9 different checks against the data, and so those are the ones that have been authorized by the legislature over time, and they range from, you know, death and citizenship to guardianship and felon conviction. So those are the backup for determining the eligibility of a voter. Would somebody want to go and say that somebody else was a felon as a way to create a negative impression of them in their local community? I don't know if that has happened. I don't know if somebody would do that. But you have human beings in the process. So in each polling place, we always have 2 election judges of opposite major political parties at every step of the process. So if somebody came in and there was any question, those 2 election judges of different major political parties would have to figure out how to handle a situation that might have resulted from somebody having some nefarious purpose in mind. But this has not been something that we've had significant or any problem with up until now. But you can imagine that human beings are capable of almost anything. And so we've built at least 9 sets of redundancy into our verification of eligibility. And using an electronic device and digital technology can help us with that process. And also putting picture taking into the polling place for those very few people who aren't in the system is also another form of deterrent. People typically, if they're trying to do something nefarious, they don't want their picture taken in that moment.
Ms. Frazier.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to add to what Secretary Ritchie was saying, the idea of adding the photos would be a process done by matching driver's license number on voter records and then using the associated photo and matching that. So that would be, there would be an initial load because we don't currently have any photos in the system. And then what we've talked to the Department of Vehicle Services about is having something nightly or weekly, at least getting updated photos for people that have registered, as well as if anyone's gone in and gotten a new picture taken, getting the updated picture. We, in terms of checks on Election Day registrants, we run several of the checks that Secretary Ritchie was referring to, both before the election to mark people's records, but also after the election to ensure that nobody voted who shouldn't have. And so that those checks both before and after the election would continue. And county auditors are well aware that the statute makes making an unauthorized change to a voter's record a felony. And so they are very careful when making changes, and I don't think they would, you know, risk committing a felony to change, you know, somebody's status or something in a way that wasn't authorized, if that helps at all.
Mr. Chairman, Representative, one more thing.
Secretary.
Most people doing election day registration are simply changing their address. So they are pre-registered voters who've been in the system. We have their photograph. You know, they're part of our system. And that's what makes using the electronic or the photo in the polling place so effective, is that most people are already in our driver's license system.
Members, we have my bill still to come up today, and it's been a very interesting topic. We're going to have, this is just the first in presentation about what the technology can do. It would have to come back before our committee before we'd, you know, hear it again as an actual bill and take additional testimony, pro and con. By then we'd have a definitive fiscal note on the total costs. We've got 5 testifiers. I know Representative Erdahl has been patiently waiting his recognition from the chair. Apologize. But we have five additional folks that would like to ask questions. I'd like to be done with this by about 25 till. So, Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. First, Ms. Frazier, when did we begin same-day registration in Minnesota?
Mr. Chair and Representative Erdahl, we began same-day registration when we instituted statewide voter registration as a requirement for voting, which was in 1973.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Erdahl.
Mr. Chairman, Secretary Ritchie, maybe you've implied this, but are any other states currently doing this?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erdahl, there are electronic poll books in almost two dozen states. Many of them import aspects of data really directly from Department of Motor Vehicles. We would be the first state to import photos, but Maine and Colorado have. In Maine, the Secretary of State also has the DMV, and so there it's a very simple matter. Colorado is very interested, so the specific of pulling in the photo would be new, but pulling in data from signatures and other data is quite common now. I think in about two dozen states, and some it's limited to some parts of the state.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, Secretary Ritchie. You've, I think, given some aggregate numbers here, but my regular small townships are going to be interested, obviously, in any cost to them. So, a township with 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 people in it. Is there a cost that I can tell them?
Secretary.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erdahl. If their approach was to use the printing of the photos onto paper, there would be essentially no cost to them. But if they were of that size, that's pretty good size, compared to
maybe a little smaller. I mean, most of them are smaller.
Then getting a system for the registration, $500, $600. Getting a system for the check-in, $600 to $1,000, depending on the size of the memory and stuff like that. Under $2,000.
Okay.
The benefit goes to the county because they don't have the typing after, and so some counties have begun to talk about why it would be in their interest to do it, and we've imagined that this initial investment really ought to come because it benefits the whole state in terms of visual verification, and we would see putting that capital, that investment in that capital cost in the upfront in the bill itself. And so that the township, some of them have feared the provisional balloting idea because they would have to have new staff and new procedures. It doesn't have any of that. They could choose the all paper option, if they were tiny. It would be relatively low cost. And of course, you would want the machines to come with 5-year maintenance so that there would be no worries about that.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Secretary Ritchie, I think Representative Downey was touching on this. If that was 85,000 or whatever that don't have photos, if they show up to vote, they have their driver's license or whatever, would that then suffice if there's no other picture of them?
Secretary Ritchie.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erdahl, of that 84,000, a certain portion of them would already be in because they're just older and they go back 12 years. They might have a student ID or something could just be used, or it could just be take their picture right there on the spot. But they would not, if they've been voting since Roosevelt and they're just so old they don't have a photo ID, there are ways to make sure that they're not disenfranchised and that we get them into the system because ultimately we want the secure system.
Representative Erdahl.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Secretary Ritchie, if they don't have a photo on record, they're one of the 84,000, but they do then produce one. Is that somewhat similar to what the photo ID is trying to do?
Secretary Ritchie.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erdahl, this would be like some clerical error where if they had a photo from the Minnesota Department of Motor Vehicles or if they had an ID, they should be in the database. So But anyhow, you would have it right there. You just scan it and put them in. So, you know, you could handle. I mean, there will always be anomalies. There will always be, or maybe they had gone in on Monday, the day before the election, and gotten, you know, gotten. I mean, I don't know how you get it that quick. But I believe that of those 84,000, what we're mostly talking about is quite old people who gave up driving, gave up their license, maybe more than 12 years ago, but maybe 12 years ago or less, and that we would work hard to make sure that, you know, we weren't, you know, negatively impacting our senior citizens.
Representative Ergall.
Thank you, Representative Benson. Just one more.
Okay.
Yeah, so your contention is that the photo ID program, Representative Kiffmeyer's bill, it would be unnecessary under what you're proposing.
Secretary Ritchie.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Erdahl, a nice thing would be to be able to bring your ID and to swipe it and have the screen pop up fast. But if you were an old person and you were going to be prevented from voting, if you'd been voting since Roosevelt, that would not happen under having the photo in the polling place. So one of the data card people made a very interesting comment that they were swiping them and moving them through so fast that they got a big line backed up in the optical scan machine. And so how you synchronize all of your steps so that you're not backing up people who are waiting to stick their ballot into the machine is an important part of the process. And so you can take your ID and just scan it, you know, with a little picture thing. Some IDs, but not all, you can scan in this way. I have had some members of the House of Representatives who are very, very concerned about identification and privacy and other issues be quite nervous about the swiping part. They don't know what, you know, they don't know what's what, but scanning it was a simpler thing for them, and the little red light often used in libraries that can pick up on barcodes, they were less nervous about that, but they still had some nervousness about the privacy issue. So thinking through the way that we could make the system move smoothly and quickly but not trigger privacy issues unnecessarily, you know, that we wouldn't need to. You know, most people are going to walk in with something, but if you lost your wallet, you won't.
Members, remember, this will not be the last bite of the apple, so.
Thank you.
Your bill isn't that great.
It's a great bill. Shame on you. I'm the chair today. Representative Simon, thank you. Mr. Chair, I had some questions that I won't ask, but I mean, I think this is intriguing. I think I see it a little differently than Representative Downey does. I don't think that this is a either or necessarily. I mean, you know, this is my driver's license. I see this as a means to an end, not in an end of itself. This tells someone who I am, potentially. But if the same information that's on this card, which is a photo from Department of Motor Vehicles or from the DBS, if this same information is already at the polling place, then if I don't have my ID, it's the same thing as this. So potentially what it means is that if Representative Erdahl gets mugged on the way to the polling place, he can go into the polling place, and his photo will already be there. Not only a photo, the photo, the same photo as this, will be at the polling place. So someone can compare his face and say, Dean, too bad, tough luck, you got mugged on the way in, things happen, but I know it's you, because the same photo that was on the card that was just stolen from you, the exact same photo, is in the polling place. I just don't see the disconnect. I see it's maybe not a proposal you're making, but the proposal is to have the same exact photo on this card already waiting for you in the polling place. So I don't see why you'd necessarily need both. You could have a citizen walk in who is a driver, and their photo would already be there. So it puts the burden not on the citizen, it puts the burden on the government to tell them that they can't vote. But it's the same means of verification. It's the same exact, the same precise photo. So that's how I see it, anyway, potentially working out. But I guess my one question is, how would this work then in terms of a challenge? Because now we're opening up a new avenue of challenge. Let's say someone's physical appearance has changed since the photo, the driver's license photo, whether it's presence or absence of facial hair, different hairstyle,
or maybe something worse, a disfigurement of some kind because of an accident. How would that work then in terms of a challenge at the polling place?
Secretary Richards.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, quickly in the language that's structured into the bill that we'll be moving forward, it says that if there's a question, then two judges of opposite major political parties would sit and have the person sign a sworn affidavit, you know, the normal procedure for handling a challenge. Especially in the modern day and age, this might come up, and you just want to have the normal procedure of having people of opposite political parties, you know, taking care of any place where there's a challenge.
Representative. So, Mr. Chair, basically this is just the same old, just in a different dimension. It's no different than if someone walked in and said, John Doe isn't really John Doe for other reasons other than the photograph, or John Doe is an immigrant without citizenship, or John Doe is a felon. There's no difference here, right? It's just adding a different dimension, but it's settled in the same old way. Secretary?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Simon, yes, except you'd have the picture,
right,
which is a big difference.
Follow-up, Representative? Representative Slavik.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a couple brief comments. First of all, I think that this is a great idea. I think it's innovative. I think it's thoughtful. I think it's cutting edge. And I think the Secretary is a leader in bringing this to us. So I want to thank you for thinking of this. I think of when we look at problems you look at Representative Lohmer had a bill on you can't allow dues to come out of union pay, which there is no child care union, because she saw a problem coming. She wanted to offer a solution to a problem that wasn't there. What the Secretary doing, and we haven't talked about this, but how I see this, is he sees the trend of voter ID coming. We all see this. We see a very expensive campaign unrolling over the next several months, and he brings a solution. Here it is. So why not take a look at it? I think that it is a good idea. I think it's something we definitely need to think about, and I hope it's something we move forward on. The other thing I have to say, Mr. Chair, is I'm sorry that Representative Gunther is gone, because I look at this picture and I think this young lady who could be his daughter or my daughter or my sister and have felon stamped across her face would be a tragedy. You know, we went on a tour of homeless people last week, and we visited these apartments, and there was a young woman there with a young child. And someone asked, so why is she homeless? A number of reasons, but one of was she was a felon. So when she takes out her ID and her young child is sitting there, when they can get to read, they're going to see mommy has felon stamped across her face every time she gets her license out. I think that is just outrageous idea of this is a place where we have dignity and respect and integrity for all people, and the idea of stamping felon across people's faces, people make mistakes. This was a young person. The rest of her life to have to go through her license every time she takes it out, having felon stamped across her face, is just outrageous.
Secretary Rich, I'm not sure that was the intent that would ever be on the license. It would be someplace in the file, electronically, only at the poll place, and hopefully the bill that will come out will notify folks that are felon, convicted felons that are in some kind of work release program or release program. You know, would get proper notification and wouldn't show up. But nevertheless, I don't know that it was ever intended that it would be stamped on the driver's license.
Mr. Chair, maybe I misheard, but that's what I heard.
Okay. Representative Leidiger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I want to pursue the collection of the data. Now, there's something that really concerns me, and that is we're talking about how many machines again? 5,000 machines, let's say? Mm. Any machines again? 5,000 machines, let's say?
Mm. Could be.
Could be.
Yeah.
Each one having the capacity and capability of containing the entire voter database. So
Representative Leidiger, for the sake of time, can we parse that question and just ask that?
Yeah,
because this came in during the committee, the integrity committee, that actually each book will not necessarily have to contain all of the state's information. Can you answer that for us?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Representative, yes, the bottom line is you want your precinct. And then if you are in a area where people are, you know, moving within, let's say Minneapolis, St. Paul, where people move across, you might want to have enough in there so that when people move, it's easy. The capacity now to hold a big fat file that's a photo along with the data makes almost anything possible. So, you know, this is the safety and privacy concerns are paramount, and it's one of the things why thinking through the process is really important. Do it carefully.
Representative Leidecker.
Mr. Chairman, okay, and then how's it collected? How's that data collected?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Leidecker, collected meaning...
How does the data get off the poll book and get counted?
Yeah.
Secretary.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Leidecker, end of the night, the stick with the data from the poll book and the Election Day registration would be sealed and go to the chief election official. So typically it's either the city or the county, and they would then download that information into their system for history and all the, you know, all of those things.
Representative.
Okay, so if one precinct has that greater area and contains the same data as something in another one, how happen to be the same file is voted on twice, how's that rectified? Or can that happen?
I think it will be a specific file, so it will be partitioned within the stick in terms of what's on it. But, I mean, they'll be downloading primarily just the precinct that the information needs to be downloaded to the state for.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Representative Green.
Thank you. My question was asked by Representative Simon.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
Now this great bill. I'm going to turn the gavel over to Representative Murray.
Bring in the third turn.
Okay, Representative Benson, would you like to move your bill?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I'd like to ask for approval to pass, and I have a fiscal note now that it would go to Ways and Means.
Okay, let's go ahead, and I believe you have a DE2 amendment. Would you like to, let's do that first so we can get it in the shape you want it?
I do. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like for... approval of the DE2 amendment. The DE2 amendment gets into the language that the author always originally intended it for it to look like. I took some comments that were made in GovOps and incorporated those, but the language is far more permissive now. And what it does, it basically adds a particular topic, reorganization of the administrative function in the agencies, and puts it under the master contract that was let last year.
Okay, does anybody have any questions on the DE2 amendment? Seeing none, all in favor of the amendment signify by saying aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Amendment is approved. Representative Benson, go ahead and proceed with the presentation of your bill.
So the bill is intended to add, if you remember last year from our conversations in this very, and the bill that was passed, actually, the omnibus bill that was passed, we added a number of items under a master contract that's administered by the Commissioner of Administration, of which we had a report back in January on, that did things like tax analytics, took a look at fleet management and the like, and basically provided for a contract that would allow for companies like IBM, and there was a number of them that bid, that could bring services to a particular agency that would allow for them to do a study on the efficiencies that could be found if they incorporated the findings of the studies. So in tax analytics, there was a number of things, both from the standpoint of identifying additional revenues, using an analytics to find out who should be paying more. In fleet management, it was to delve into if, you know, with just the idea of economy of scale, of bringing the contracts into a centralized contract that they could find efficiencies that would help
reduce the cost. What this bill does is to expand it by one additional item in that it would add under the master contract services from companies who come in and take a look at how management within an organization is structured. One and two of the reorganization along service rather than functional lines in order to provide for more efficient and effective services. The members from the previous committee will recognize that I put effective service in there because of the thought that in government it's not always efficient because of the differences between providing effective. So I've added that in there. Number two, internal reorganization in order to flatten out the organization structure by requiring that decisions are made closest to the service needed, eliminating redundancies and optimizing the span of control ratios to public and private sector industry benchmarks. The idea there is to take a look at, we have a very vertical structure, management structure. What we're trying to do is to look for ways that we can make the management there more responsive to not only to the people who gain from the services of the public in Minnesota, but also the employees that have to carry that out, with an understanding that the closer that the people at the top are to the people who have to manage the people actually getting the work done, always the more empowered those employees feel about making decisions relative to getting the work done. And from efficiency standpoint, you know, if it's a question about, well, here we go again, are we just trying to eliminate staff? That's not the intent. That could be a byproduct, but it's not the intent. You know, if it does point out that we have too many middle-level managements or span of control is such that, you know, we have too few or even too many, a decision would have to be made by the organization, the agency, with a report back to the legislature about what they intended to do with that. And it could be that through natural attrition, as this report or this study rolls out, they begin to say that we need to keep positions open to make sure that once this is all implemented and deployed and implemented, that we won't be looking at pink slipping anyone. It'll be simply a matter of moving people around to the areas that they're most qualified to be in. I'd stand for questions.
Do any of the members have questions? Seeing none, are there anybody in the audience that would like to speak for or against this bill? Good morning, Mr. Yoakum. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name and...
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Kurt Yoakum. I'm the legislative director for the Department of Administration. I'm not here to speak for or against the bill. I just wanted to bring up a couple points that the representative and I discussed yesterday. As the representative brought up, within the last year, the Department of Administration did put together the master contract for data analytics. And conceivably, what is being proposed here today could fit in with within a couple of the service categories that were that are part of that master contract for data analytics. Just provided that they definitely do kind of meet the definition of data analytics or the kind of the industry standards for that. And then at that point, I think the reporting requirement that's required in the legislation would be the effective part impacting the Department of Administration. Had agencies decided, or if the intent was to go a different direction where it's not necessarily your standard data analytics type contract or type proposal, and then as the representative and I spoke about yesterday, you would need that regular RFP process to go through, and just given, I think it's outlined adequately in the fiscal note, but an RFP process, especially when you're developing something like a master contract, that's a fairly lengthy process, and regardless of how many resources the state throws into that, on the vendor end who has to respond to the RFP, they need certain time. They need a certain amount of time in order to respond to that. And so, if we need to go through the regular RFP process, I think the timeline that's in the legislation, we would not be able to have that master contract completed by the beginning of September. I would think last year with the master contract for data analytics, we began that at some point in April, and the final signatures were there in December, mid-December, and that was actually a fairly aggressive process there, and so I just asked that the committee be cognizant of that. Otherwise, I would stand for questions, or I have some folks from the material management division here that could answer any technical questions should you have those. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Yolf.
Mr. Chairman, actually, I have a question.
Cool.
I thought of this before the committee, and you know, in taking a look at the master contract, there already is some language regarding organization. What I'm trying to do with this is to pin that down to make sure that there's a definitive, we're talking about organization as in the administration. My question is, could it, because this would go to whether or not you'd need indeed to do an RFP, and which would eliminate the fiscal note entirely and allow for it to go to the register, is that if if we did an amendment here that would allow for language to be in included that would say, under the current contract, I talked with Mr. Shepard. Mr. Shepard, could you make any comments regarding how that might...
Mr. Shepard.
Mr. Chair and Representative Benson, two thoughts. First, just in regard to the language in the DE2 amendment, if the author's intent was to clarify that this list would be developed from an existing master contract, then on the amendment DE2 on page 1, line 5, you could delete the word A and insert an existing, and that would clarify Representative Benson's intent. The second comment would be, I don't know what Mr. Yocum testified that he wasn't sure if they could do it under an existing contract if they had the right vendors, and so my suggestion wouldn't address that. But it would just clarify that they could use, that this would be under an existing master contract program if that were possible.
Mr. Yocum.
Mr. Chairman, going back, addressing Mr. Shepard's second point, the intent, you know, I think if, I'm going to have Ms. Hayes correct me if I'm wrong there, but if the intent is to say that this is part of the data analytics contract, I think that the how the state agency approaches, they would have to have their approach within, I think, the confines of the RFPs or the responses that we have received from vendors in those service categories. And in that point, then, I think that would be acceptable. I'll let the expert actually address that a little bit more so.
Good morning. Welcome. Please state your name for the committee.
Thank you. Good morning. My name is Betsy Hayes. I'm a contracts manager with the Department of Administration. Mr. Chair, one of the issues that we have to be cognizant of, I think, is that when we developed the master contract program for data analytics last year, an RFP went out and described the scope of that particular program. So if we were to add new tasks, it would need to be within that scope of what was announced and what vendors responded to. This type of reorganizational services, there is a category in the data analytics program that focuses on organizational improvement, and as long as the project at hand fits into that, what was described, and into the current program, certainly the current program could be used. Such a project would need to be data focused. It would need to fall within sort of the scope of what is conceived as data analytics in the industry. If the project that the agency wanted to undertake to do a reorganizational analysis or something to that effect, if it was outside the scope of the data analytics master contract and not related really to data analytics, it would be outside the scope for them to use this particular program, and they would need to do an independent RFP. So does that clarify at all?
Representative Benson?
It does. I did not have, I had a testifier in the previous committee, and it was IBM that came in and did that. And almost all of the decisions that they would derive from their study would come from data. You know, of course, they're going to look at things like overall mission, vision, and strategy, current and future business culture, customer strategies, employee strategies, and the like. But all that's going to be drawn from some kind of data file on
on a number of things. So I have a feeling that it would already fit within the scope of the work. But I also don't have any problem with moving it forward. It's a pretty small amount. They were actually the more involved in the RFP. So do you have any thoughts to that, Ms. Hayes?
Mr. Chair, I think it would be something that we would need to look at project by project, and really try to understand how it is that they would approach the specific project at hand to really be certain that it fits the data analytics, the scope. And the concern would be that if we have an overly broad interpretation, that it's not giving other vendors the chance to participate in a program if they didn't expect that the scope would be that broad when the original RFP was announced last year.
Representative Benson?
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I think I would, rather than trying to change it on the fly and making sure that my intent is that I don't want it so watered down that all they can do is look at a computer program to make decisions, relative to span of control and those kinds of things, that I would rather just pass and be referred to Ways and Means, and we can find, there might be time between now and that time that we could take a harder look at it to see if whether or not it would encompass what I'm trying to accomplish with the bill, but I prefer not to try to change it on the fly now. Between now and then, we can I can also talk with these folks about if September 1st isn't a good date, we're not going to have a report back to January. We could make it November 1st or time that reflects, the opportunity to get the work done.
Okay. It sounds like maybe we could do a little work offline if Ms. Hayes and Mr. Yoakum could work, Representative Benson, work with you. And
absolutely.
And work on some of that. Okay, do any of the members have any questions for the testifiers? Is there anybody else in the audience that wishes to testify for or against this bill? Okay, any additional questions for the author? Seeing none, would you like to wrap up?
Thank you. I think this is it's a good bill. From the standpoint that we did many things last year, but we didn't take a hard look at the overall management structure of the agencies. And this bill doesn't force them, studies and the like. I had a lot of Minskews here today. I know that they're delighted by the fact that they're not mentioned necessarily by name. But this is another tool in the toolkit that can be used by agencies to take a harder look at, are we really focused on doing the kinds of things that we're tasked with, and do we have the management structure and the alignment as such in a way that we can accomplish it the most efficient, effective way possible. So I would renew my motion that it pass and be referred to Ways and Means.
Okay, thank you to the testifiers for joining us today. And with that, Representative Benson renews his motion that House File 1813 be recommended to pass as amended and be re-referred to the Ways and Means Committee. All in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The bill is passed. Thank you. Are there any other? Okay, we have presentations for bonding proposals from the Department of Veterans Affairs and the Minnesota Amateur Sports Commission tomorrow, and also discussion of cost proposed for the State Veterans Cemetery in Fillmore City.
County.
Okay. So thank you, everyone, and the meeting is adjourned.